Billy got picked on at school for things he couldn't change. He tried his best to play it cool, but in the seventh grade, you either fit right in or you don't fit. That's just the cold hard truth. I wish that I'd have been the friend that Billy never knew. I think it's time to come together, you and I can make a change. Maybe we can make a difference, make the world a better place. Look around and love somebody, we've been hateful long enough. Let the good Lord reunite us to this country that we love's undivided.
Yup. You either go to church or you're gonna go to hell. Get a job and work or you're gonna go to jail. I just kinda wish we didn't think like that. Why's it gotta be all white or all black? And when we gonna learn to try on someone's shoes sometimes?
Welcome back.
When we gonna start to see from someone else?
Top of the second hour of today's Road Warrior radio broadcast this Friday, April 21st. 2023 on the one and only Republic Broadcasting Network. And again, continuing to explore the rapid, unscheduled disassembly of American culture as SpaceX principal integration engineer. What is a principal integration engineer anyway? A PIE, P-I-E. John Innsbrucker might say. After the crack up, I thought it was, you know, isn't that just an explosion? What would George Carlin say about all this? A rapid, unscheduled disassembly. Speaking of which, let me just do a little bit of history real fast. Speaking of the rapid, unscheduled disassembly, you know, in this case of American culture, what is happening? You know, we've always had this duality, and that way you can, at any given moment, you can shift in one direction or the other. With at least a degree of plausible deniability, and you give some kind of specious or surreptitious justification, and you know people buy into it. We've been double-minded for thousands of years. Why don't we just keep doing this? So, you know, you listen to folks talk about the Peace of Westphalia from Kissinger on. The Peace of Westphalia is mentioned and what it represents before, you know, May Day, before May 1, 1776 is, and there was this Illuminized contingent before May 1, 1776. We don't hear about it a lot. The history is sort of truncated like Masonry. Does it go back to Solomon? No, it goes back to Genesis 11. Read Genesis 11 and ask yourself who builds with brick and mortar and wants to make for themselves a name that endures throughout the ages. May Day 1776 is a truncated history to keep you from really understanding the scope and breadth of what's going on. And 1648 represents the moment where that Illuminized plot really sort of begins in with concerted fervor, where it's the, you know, kind of the balkanization of the monarchic structure, if you will. And it's really an attack on monarchy, but not monarchy. It's indirectly an attack on God and getting God out of all things. The God of the Bible, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, creator of heaven and earth. How can we get rid of him and not her, him? How can we get rid of him? And so the monarchies had leaned on divine right of kings as their, you know, the basis of their rulership. So we, you know, our lineage ties back to David, and therefore, you know, the house of David, and so therefore we have a divine right to rule and to be kings. And so since the Peace of Westphalia, you can see the breaking up of that and the continual fracturing of that until we get to really America and this idea that, you know, we have a union of several states. But then all of a sudden, since we've really seen the, you know, and 1776 obviously is an important moment in our history for different reasons, various reasons, you might say. But then we come forward to America, and you can see how from the Peace of Westphalia to, you know, maybe 1871, that the fracturing, the Balkanization continues, and then all of a sudden, you know, if we're looking in terms of American history, all of a sudden there is this effort to start to weld things together differently and without God. Divine right of kings needs to go away. We got to get rid of monarchy. Now we're going to have the, you know, the Platonic, technocratic, scientific dictatorship, you know, democratic socialism, the Fabian democratic socialism. We'll have some poobahs, but they'll be, you know, it'll be a council of benevolent dictators, and they'll tell everyone what to do, but it's patently ungodly, patently without God. Pretty sure Fred in Iowa and John in Tennessee would agree with me. So now we're starting to see the culmination of this effort to, you know, it's been to break things apart entirely, and now we're seeing the effort to weld things back together imperviously, unbreakably forever, to finish the great unfinished work of Genesis 11 that God disrupted. That's what's happening. And, you know, it's interesting that we heard throughout the 20th century in particular about this. You know, James Corbett just did the brilliant piece on Fifth Generation Warfare, episode 441, Your Guide to Fifth Generation Warfare. But it's so much broader than that. And it really, I mean, he did a great job. But, you know, how can you tell that story in 30 or 60 minutes? When it encompasses everything. Total war means total war. It's obviously it's psychological. It's you know, it's everything. It's social, it's economic, it's political. And like Frank Kitson observed in Low Intensity Operations, it is primarily, it's the stuff, and this is something that John Arquilla and David Ronfeld mentioned in The Advent of Net War back in 1996. You know, this is primarily low-intensity conflict and operations other than war. They mentioned that, I think, right out of the gates in The Advent of Net War. They have that little image in chapter 2, titled Conceptual Outlines, on page 3 of the document, 13 of the PDF, Information Age Conflict Spectrum, Cyber War, HIC, MRC, and Net War, LIC, OOTW. So they, you know, kind of spell it out. Assumptions across spectrum, nature of threat and defense is altered. New concepts are needed for military organization, doctrine, strategy, technology. RMA is mostly about information revolution. So to explain what all of these, you know, letters, the alphabet soup means, they write, in our view, the information age conflict spectrum looks like this. What we term cyber war, quote unquote, will be an ever more important entry at the military end, where the language is normally about, and this is the thing that I just keep trying to get across to people, that I think James did a great job in episode 441 of doing, saying this, what Arquilla and Ronfeld said in the advent of NetWar. How do they know? Because these are the people at RAND Corporation who are, you know, they're the authors and scripters of the, you know, Clash of Civilizations. They're orchestrating it. Anyway, what we term cyber war will be an ever more important entry at the military end, where the language is normally about high intensity conflict, HIC, and middle range conflict, MRC. Net war, quote unquote, will figure increasingly at the social end, where the language is normally about low intensity conflict, LIC, and operations other than war, OOTW, a broader concept than LIC, low intensity conflict, that includes peacekeeping and humanitarian relief operations, or, you know, stability operations and nation building, as RAND Corporation would say. Whereas cyber war will usually see formal military forces pitted against each other, net war is more likely to involve non-state, paramilitary, and other irregular forces. Both concepts are consistent with the views of an analyst like Van Creveld in 91, who believe that a transformation of war is underway, leading to increased irregularization. There's a term for you, increased irregularization. Terms above reflect two assumptions or propositions about the information revolution. One is that conflicts will increasingly depend on and revolve around information and communications, cyber matters broadly defined. Indeed, both cyber war and net war are modes of conflict that are largely about knowledge, quote unquote, about who knows what, when, where, and why, and about how secure a society, military, or other actor is regarding its knowledge of itself and its adversaries. That's funny. If I didn't know better, I would say that sounds, sort of eerily reminiscent of Sun Tzu saying, if you know your enemies and you know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles. If you do not know your enemies nor yourself, you will be imperiled in every single battle. If I didn't know better, I would think that's what Ronfeld or Arquilla and Ronfeld are getting at in the advent of net war. I digress. Anyway, let's back up and unpack this stuff piece by piece a little bit, whatever we can in the moments here. We'll start with low intensity operations. This stuff that they're talking about in the advent of net war. Listen carefully. Webster Tarpley, in less than 3 minutes, pretty much spells out just about everything that you see when it comes to, let's call it terrorism generally. You know, how does terrorism work? And what is the war on terror and the war on terrorism? Webster Tarpley, go ahead, please.
The notion of a U.S. war on terrorism is simply a fraud. There is no war on terrorism. The Anglo-Americans are backing terrorists exactly when and where it suits them, from Chechnya to Cuba to other points around the world. This is a typical British strategy. You've got to know the name of Brigadier General Sir Frank Kitson. He was the British operations officer in Kenya at the time of the Mau Mau. And what Kitson saw, which has been known to commanders for centuries, millennia, if you've got an underground nationalist organization and you want to discredit them, you create your own parallel underground nationalist organization. You send them out. It's got to have the same name. It's got to have a false flag. You send them out, have it commit tremendous atrocities. Those will be blamed on the original, relatively benign group, and they'll be discredited, they'll be demonized, and you gain political advantage. He wrote a book about it called Low Intensity Operations. And the technique is called the technique of the counter gang or the pseudo gang. Just as Al-Qaeda, in the broader sense, is a pseudo gang or counter gang created by U.S. and British and Israeli intelligence. It's a counter gang against normal Arab nationalists or anybody with any positive agenda for reform or independence or development anywhere in the Arab world, they can always be labeled al-Qaeda. The reductio ad absurdum of this is President Chavez of Venezuela, after giving Bush a hard time at various conferences and doing things to undermine the dollar, the neocons are now accusing President Chavez of being a member of al-Qaeda. So you can see how easy it is to demonize somebody once you've got a good counter gang going. There's an oligarchical consensus in the United States, inspired by the neocons, inspired by Samuel Huntington and the rest of them, which is that without an enemy image, you cannot have an oligarchical society. Ultimately, that's the why. Because if you look at this, you say, terrorism, endless war, why, who benefits? Those who benefit are the beneficiaries of the current system, financiers primarily. They feel that without the diversion of a war, they cannot maintain social relations, property relations in the current form. And this they are determined to do. So they have manufactured, in a complete hysteria, a largely fictitious external enemy. You remember 1984 by George Orwell. Julia at one point says, I don't even think there is a war. It's just a fake to keep people under control. Orwell, I think, had a very good understanding of some of these psychological mechanisms.
So there you go. That's it in a nutshell. I mean, 3 minutes, man. You know, if everybody really, if we all in America really understood the mechanics of what Webster Tarpley is talking about there, Frank Kitson and the counter gang or pseudo gang strategy, creating your enemy. You know, the best way to control the opposition is to lead it or create it. And sometimes that means creating false opposition so that, you know, you can perpetuate this lie. Why? To achieve and maintain power. And so it's ironic. You know, I mentioned yesterday, obviously, resistance operating concept and the manual, particularly by Otto Fiala, Kirk Smith, and Anders Lofberg. And, you know, I need to go back to that and actually, you know, maybe I'll do that right now. Because, yeah, we'll do that real fast. It's astonishing, the dishonesty, the blatant dishonesty of the language. Let's see. Some of the, you know, what do I mean as far as, you know, dishonesty in the language is concerned? From the forward, beginning in the forward. Let's see, this publication applies a sharp focus on one aspect of unconventional warfare, resistance. This is hybrid warfare, especially when the hostile power tries to mask its intentions. Now, you know, think about the irony of this, you know, from NATO. This is hybrid warfare, especially when the hostile power tries to mask its intentions. When a nation loses control of territory, resistance is applicable. Nations under threat from neighbors must build resilience into their societies. You know, this is sort of the antithesis of, and exactly what Muammar Gaddafi's, what I call 9/11 truth speech, September 23rd, I want to say, 2009, 9/11 truth speech was all about. How come the UN Security Council turns a blind eye to... Anyway, we'll be right back. Stick around.
Standing 6'4", weighing 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science-analyzing brawn, Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian, and my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. F*** you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be the bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
Consider this. Dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. One of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com. Be glad to help you out. Be glad to answer your questions. That's what we're here for. No pressure, just good, hard, common sense. The decision then becomes up to you.
Welcome back. Okay. So, continuing with the absurdity that Webster Tarpley points out of the kidnapper crying victim, which is the psychopathy we seem to be submerged in America these days. It's insane. I think, you know, again, I think folks like Christopher Rufo do a magnificent job of unpacking that and saying just how absurd it really is, and that they have no solutions. We just want to gripe, but we don't necessarily have any answers for anything. And I think, you know, Mike Rowe is right. Let's just get back to work. Let's be quiet and be like our grandparents. Get back to work. So from the resistance operating concept document, again, the absurdity and the hypocrisy of language, at least in my humble opinion, from the foreword, starting there, continuing there, I should say, resilience is a nation's will and ability to withstand external pressure, influence, and possible incursion. A united society with a vibrant sense of national identity can more easily withstand external malign influence. That's funny because, you know, that's both in America in dialectical cognitive dissonance sort of fashion. Those are the two ends that have been, you know, we've been whipsawed back and forth between. We should have a national identity. If you are, you know, a national identity kind of person, then you are a racist and a domestic terrorist. So that's part of our own insanity. But we have this document that was authored by NATO forces and principally, you know, United States military forces. So again, do we have an identity crisis? But we're projecting that kind of schizophrenia around the world. How fantastic. What could possibly go wrong? Continuing, resilience is the fundamental foundation of resistance. Okay. And then this, resistance planning must involve not only the military, but government agencies and ministries at the national and local levels. So i.e. Continuity of government then, right? It's and they even mentioned, as I said yesterday, in this document you see whole of government, whole of society even approach to matters. And that, again, is a sociocracy sort of concept, which is communitarian, Fabian socialist, Platonic, you know, council of the, you know, philosopher kings, etc., etc. Anyway, it must also involve non-governmental elements of society. The nation as a whole must plan for and be involved in various aspects of its defense. And the irony in all of this is, you know, you see, you know, again, if you look into sociocracy as an example, we do rounds. Everyone gets heard and it helps us listen to each other better. Not necessarily. And you're leaning, I think, heavily on what Mencken is credited as referring to as the collective ignorance of individual wisdom, or excuse me, the collective wisdom of individual ignorance, which is a fallacy because we get together. We must be smarter. No, in fact, it's usually the contrary. But what it does is it gives confirmation bias, and it also preys on a form of effort justification. We all participated, therefore we have buy-in, therefore this is a good thing. And who was it that pointed out? Oh, it was G. Edward Griffin that talked about how, and I want to say Gary Allen wrote about it in the Rockefeller file, but G. Edward Griffin talked about how, who was it that saw, Rockefeller saw that, who was it that was, getting the community to, you know, he would do matching contributions. We will build this hospital. I'll put up the first 500,000. The community puts up the rest, matching funds, and then it gets people's buy-in. It's effort justification bias. Fred would appreciate the mention of cognitive dissonance and effort justification bias. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because big tech, big pharma, and big brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we the people are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
Einstein once said, "Future medicine will be the medicine of frequencies." What did he know? Imagine you hear ocean waves caressing a beach, or a favorite song from the past, or the trickle of the babbling brook. All of these are sound frequencies that positively affect us. Terahertz is a soothing, healing frequency that has been proven to resonate at the same frequency as healthy cells. It penetrates the body and stimulates new healthy cell growth. Want to diminish muscle aches, joint pains, and experience a greater sense of well-being? Tired of spending money on short-term remedies that never seem to work? Soothing, healing, relaxing terahertz frequency is now available, and as handy as flipping a switch. Terahertz technology is changing the course of what we were taught about how to maintain our health and well-being. To read more about this amazing breakthrough and to order your terahertz frequency wand, go to naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on a tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun.
Welcome back.
You know what I mean, don't you know?
Perfect. Another key point to the historical lens is Afghanistan, you know, the place where empires and great military leaders go to die, sometimes literally. That's why Afghanistan is so important. That region is so important, because if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. And so that's been, you know, the mission of NATO and ISAF. That's why RL33627, NATO and Afghanistan, a test of the Transatlantic Alliance, is so important for people to read. And, you know, but who has time to review that kind of stuff, and who is willing to set aside their own greed and personal proclivities, or, you know, that of Junior Asparagus, who wants to be, you know, thinks they want to be a war fighter or whatever, you know, a soldier of fortune or whatever. Who has time and who has the proclivity to set aside, you know, one's own, you know, speaking of know yourself and your enemy. Anyway, the resistance operating concept from the preface, let's define terms, shall we? So as a culmination of these efforts, you know, the efforts that they did over a period of years, they define terms, define resilience as the will and ability to withstand external pressures and influences and or recover from the effects of those pressures and influences. Resistance, define resistance as a nation's organized whole of society. There's that whole of society effort encompassing the full range of activities from nonviolent to violent, led by a legally established government, potentially exiled, displaced, or shadow, to reestablish independence and autonomy within its sovereign territory that has been wholly or partially occupied by a foreign power. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah, isn't that what we've been doing in these, you know, nation-building spates, as RAND Corporation says, since World War II? But this is where it gets interesting. Provides a common understanding of terms defined within previous seminars and by reference to publicly available U.S. military doctrine. So, you know, this gets into where Otto Fiala has talked about, well, you know, we were talking to our foreign partners, you know, frenemies. They're friends right now, but who knows what, I mean, they weren't yesterday, and who knows what they'll be tomorrow, but right now they're convenient friends. When we talk to these people, you know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, because there are pirates and emperors, but they're really the same thing. Anyway, so they had to define terms. No, what you guys are saying, you know, the occupying force. No, those are the liberators. Guys, come on. Let's get the terms straight here. So they define terms. Adversary and enemy, quote unquote, are used to describe an aggressor state. That's funny, because, you know, the guys coordinating these meetings seem to be the adversary, enemy, aggressor state. The term adversary is used to describe the aggressor state prior to conflict, while enemy is used after that adversary becomes the foreign occupier and national resistance becomes necessary to restore national sovereignty, which, you know, again, I think is painfully ironic. So, you know, it's funny when you start to think in terms of, you know, what Noam Chomsky has said about who projects power around the world, which nation has the largest military budget in the world, which nation has the most military bases around the world, you know, any metric. What are we doing? I think that, you know, so who benefits in that? Who wins? Do we win as Americans? Not really. Military-industrial complex obviously wins big. The folks who want to control and divvy up the world for nefarious and shadowy purpose and influences, they, you know, that contingent obviously benefits. The rest of us, Americans in the world at large, do not benefit. You know, this interventionist policy of we got to go. It's not so much interventionism as it is the Hellenization of the world. It's the re-Hellenizing, the Hellenizing influence. So it's not cultural Marxism or cultural assimilation or hegemony as much as it is the old Hellenizing influence. to, you know, create a platonic utopia in the march toward finishing the great unfinished work of Genesis 11. That's what's really going on. Anyway, enough with the terminology and the, you know, just the sort of reinforcement of Webb Tarpley's point. And again, you know, brilliant 3-minute breakdown of exactly how and why the war on terror and terrorism is a fraud. Again, I mentioned, you know, Tarpley mentioned Frank Kitson, low-intensity operations, the counter-gang, the pseudo-gang strategy. Low-intensity operations, subversion, insurgency, peacekeeping, published back in 1971, is the book that he's talking about, the manual, operations manual. And again, the holographic structure is visually depicted in Chapter 6, Insurgency Part 1, Tactics, the Handling of Information, on page 128, in Figure 5, which is captioned Diagrammatical Representation of a Subversive Organization in an Urban Setting. It's a holographic organization. So that's a kind of a, that's one perspective of it, and you could turn that maybe 90 degrees counterclockwise and view it as a pyramidal structure where, you know, really from kind of above the veil, directives are issued to folks who increasingly make their way out in front of the wizard's curtain and are influencing and persuading. Isn't that what psychological operations is all about? Influencing and persuading. You know, it's the Bernaysian way, dear comrades. Anyway, more on the holographic structure. Here's Jordan Peterson saying it the way he said it. Can we play that, please?
You know, you saw the same thing with Solzhenitsyn's description of the gulags, because they were run in large part by the inmates. But I think that that's a really good metaphor for totalitarian states in general, you know, because we like to think that a totalitarian state is made up of innocent, oppressed individuals who are under the thumb of an evil tyrant, and that all of the catastrophes are cascading from the top down. But I don't think that that's true. I think that it's more like a holographic structure where the tyranny exists at every single level. So it exists psychologically, and it exists within the family, and it exists within the mid-level organizations. And so, well, you know, in Eastern Germany, for example, one out of every three people was a government informer. So what that meant is if you had a family of six people, that two of them you couldn't trust. And you can't just say that that's a consequence of the top-down structure. A tyranny is something that exists everywhere simultaneously once it gets a grip. And it's easy for people to say things like, well, I was just following orders. And, you know, I'm not...
Yeah, we put a fork in it there. So, I mean, that's it. It's a holographic structure. And if we can put two and two together and realize, you know, again, if you haven't watched... Watch James Corbett's episode 441, Your Guide to Fifth Generation Warfare, and he just underscores the point. It's everything that I've been saying. You sound like, you know, a stuck record. It's not kinetic. It's not high intensity. It's low intensity. And middle intensity, as Arquilla and Ronfeld put it in The Advent of Net War back in 1996. That's what it is. It's net war. And it's these, you know, and so you listen to the, you know, discussions of what sociocracy is. What is it? Well, it's these cells. Oh, that's interesting. What have we heard since even before September 11, 2001? Terrorist cells. So basically, we're institutionalizing this form of social interaction and integration that, again, has been, it's the very thing that's been vilified. We're teaching it, and it's a military doctrine also. You know, it's you know, again, I mean, it's largely the resistance operating concept. It's a parallel to that, which again is, you know, built largely on Gene Sharp's work. Anyway, I want to give you the bit that I mentioned earlier. Deborah Marshall's video, just an excerpt from it, Pierre Bourdieu and Reflexive Sociology. And, you know, why this is important, the comment, the person who made the comment says, I've been reading about the around the internets to get a simple definition of reflexive sociology, and it has been like reading a foreign dictionary. Thanks a lot for sharing this great and engaging explanation. And I agree. It's fantastic. You'll see why, and perhaps why it applies here. Go ahead, please.
So we'll finish up our discussion of Bourdieu with his notions of reflexive sociology. And we really need to understand this concept of reflexive sociology, especially for those of us who are going to go on and do research in the discipline of psychology, social psychology, sociology, anywhere we have to study the human being. Reflexive sociology can do us a world of good. So what exactly is reflexive sociology? Well, Bourdieu would say that we really need to deepen our understanding of our own self and our position in the world to better understand the social reality of others. And really, this is tied up with that concept of the sociological imagination. We have to be able to get out of our own way of thinking about social reality and really be willing to step into the other person's shoes to understand why things are happening the way they are. In addition, reflexive sociology would require us to be skeptical of our own views. You know, oftentimes when we're having that conversation with others, or when we're seeing something happening, we're reading in the newspaper something's happening, watching on TV, or reading an article on the internet that something is occurring, we oftentimes have a knee-jerk reaction to that. Well, I would never do that. Or, why is that person doing that? That's completely ridiculous. What we never really stop to take into consideration is that other people are doing the same thing when they're observing us. And so reflexive sociology would require us to really examine what we're doing, how we think, how we feel. What are our attitudes and our beliefs and our feelings and our prejudices about particular things in social reality?
So I think you can infer the takeaway here is, are there applications for this? Yes, but when all you have is a hammer, everything becomes a nail. And when you live in a moral relativist society, it's particularly problematic. There is no baseline. There is no absolute. And so where does this go? I think it goes to Jean Baudrillard's Simulacra and Simulation. It goes into a deep, dark black hole of fantasy land in just a few degrees. And that's where it's supposed to go. You know, the question is, who decides? Ironically, in sociology or in a sociocracy, there is, like, if you go to sociocracyforall.org, they actually have a page called Who Decides, which I think is painfully ironic, you know, especially with what I've been talking about lately, Who Decides. And it's, you know, not who we think. We all become good world servers in theosophical fashion. So you can see, just listening to Deborah Marshall's brilliant distillation of reflexive sociology, what happens. You know, well, who are you? Maybe you can't trust yourself. Why do you think, you know, I mean, maybe you can't say, well, it is so because God said. I mean, who are you to say that, you know, we have no absolutes and we live in a society marked by relativism. So, you know, as John in Tennessee would say, he loved to, you know, he loved the quip that, you know, the relativist says there are no absolutes, and he would say, are you absolutely sure? That's where this goes. It's the same old radical empiricism. It's the same old skepticism from of old, from Sextus Empiricus, Pyrrho, Plato, etc., that wants you to question yourself. It's the same question that was asked in the garden. Yea, hath God said. That's what it really is. Are there times when we should be reflective and we should, you know, what do you call it? We should be introspective or whatever? Absolutely. But context is essential. Who's in charge? Who decides? What is the foundation? What is the schema by which you will make these decisions? And if you can alter the schema, then you transmogrify the meta, and you also transmogrify everything else that comes after that. So this gets into the whole Deus Ex Machina territory. Who is the God of the little black box? Deciding what happens between input and output, or stimulus and response. Anyway, to the phones. In the final moments, Mike in Kentucky, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Well, hey, you had mentioned near the top of the last hour, and I started looking and found out that the Anheuser-Busch CEO didn't resign after all, after the Bud Light's ads, according to this story, April the 10th, but then there's another story calling him former CEO. But what I was looking for was the guy's name, you know, and I didn't realize you mentioned Brendan Mulvaney, but this guy.
No, Dylan Mulvaney. Brendan Whitworth is the CEO.
Okay, well, this story says Brendan Whitworth's net worth is $35 million, and he's the CEO of Anheuser-Busch.
Right, that's what I said. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, who was the ex-CIA?
Brendan Whitworth.
Okay, well, who was the Mulvaney that you mentioned?
Dylan Mulvaney is the, you know, that's for people to look up on their own. Mulvaney is the, you know, that's provocateur right. in the discussion, basically. The,
oh, that's right. Okay.
The gender dysphoria fluidity provocateur.
Right. Okay, all right. Somehow in my listening to that, as I got a phone call, I got the names mixed up, and I'm like, wait a minute, this doesn't
gotcha.
Make any sense.
And for posterity's sake, the piece that I mentioned is Dan Dick's piece, Press for Truth. You know, it's titled CEO of Anheuser-Busch is former CIA operative now reeling over wokeism, Bud Light hangover.
Yeah, so that's if it wasn't, and the thing way before this happened that was ticking me off about Bud Light is that all along the road that I live on, there's all these dark blue Bud Light bottles that are getting tossed out, including on a neighbor lady's yard that's half nearly blind, and she still shoots pretty straight at anything moving, but the dang redneck droppings, as I call them, of Bud Light bottles are pretty dang irritating. But anyway, did you mention something the first hour about Fred from Ohio may have passed away?
Fred from Iowa. Yeah, we lost
Iowa.
Fred.
Oh, Fred.
On Good Friday.
Iowa. Well, I hadn't talked to him in a while, so I guess that's why we hadn't heard him calling in. He's been sick.
Yep.
Oh, well. Anyway, that's what I was calling about, trying to figure out how that got fixed up in my brain, I guess.
We got it.
Yeah,
we got it.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, and you're probably not the only one, so I appreciate it even more. We've got one more call that we're going to grab real quick.
I was going to suggest that they need to put the shaman man on the can and see how that helps Bud Light out.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Mike. Much appreciated. Back to the phones. Largan, Texas, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Yeah, great broadcast today.
I learned a couple of things. Sociocracy, there's a good one.
I thought you might find that interesting. I thought of you when I thought about, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that Deborah Martin referenced C. Wright Mills, the sociological imagination.
Yep. Yeah.
And I noticed over the years you've mentioned the power elite quite a lot. Mm-hmm. But I just want to remind you that the very first broadcast I ever did for RBN in 2011 was on my birthday, August 27th, 2011. And there I was referencing a book called White Collar, America's Middle Classes by C. Wright Mills.
Mm-hmm.
To basically show how all of us have been socially engineered, whether we will care to admit it or not.
Yep.
And so I thought I'd take this occasion to bring it up again. And also, you know, tomorrow is Earth Day. And it's my mother's birthday, my late mother. I lost her in 1996 when she was murdered by her doctors. And that's a provable thing. You know, the morphine drip, if you look it up, is actually a method of euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah, and I think that's what, you know, I mean, it's pretty obvious that that's what's going on in hospice. And I think hospice is a way to steal souls, quite frankly. But that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah, and as far as the war on all of us, I think it has been, I think it's pretty clear to me at this stage of my life, but it's been going on since the day I was born, and frankly, the day my parents and grandparents were born.
Mm-hmm. Now, so now you're starting to sound like George Friedman. Just kidding.
Well, anyway, I'm going to write something up about my mom for tomorrow on Facebook, so check it out when you get around to it. And
absolutely, look forward to it.
Yeah, congratulations on a wonderful show today. I always appreciate your efforts.
Thank you. And, you know, I mean, it's heady stuff, but, you know, for you, it's like, yeah, we all know that stuff, right? We all should anyway. If we could start here and, you know, act like adults instead of feckless little, you know, permanent adolescence, which is a term that John Taylor Gatto says never existed before the 20th century, then maybe we would have a shot at doing something, you know, notable. But
well, you know how it is when I consider everything I don't know.
Yeah.
And compare it to what I think I know or proclaim to know, it's really just infinitesimal by comparison. And so, yeah, you know, that's what this school is all about. We live and we learn, and we're teachers and we are students at the same time.
Amen. Can't argue with that. That's for sure. I appreciate it, sir. Much appreciated. That'll do it for today's broadcast. If you are not familiar, speaking of Earth Day, read Gary Kahn's work. Read The New World Religion, for example. That'll do it for today's broadcast. I hope you have a great weekend. I hope it was informative, possibly even edifying. And as always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. We'll catch you on the other side.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumer's house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.